Portions of this program the following may be pre-recorded. Program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the host and the guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, State Senator Fairfax Democrat Chap Peterson. Had a great session up there. Lots going on. We're happy to have him back on today. He's been so busy. Hey, Chap, great to have you, man.
John, thanks for having me. Great to be back on the show.
Chap Peterson, the man. Listen, I was so impressed yesterday when I read, and I want you to share this with our audience, you single-handedly stopped the seatbelt bill, which I liken to basically stop and for risk where you can get pulled over by a cop in Virginia if this thing passed for not doing anything, just the suspicion of not having a seatbelt on. You single-handedly stopped that. You explain that to our
Sure. audience. Well, thank you. First of all, I don't know if I single-handedly did it because 20-some people, I think 28 people joined me in voting against it, but I did speak against it, and we did kill it literally on the 11th hour because it had passed the House. Here's the deal, John. I think your analogy to stop and frisk is very apt. This law would have given the ability of the police to pull over any car just on the suspicion that an occupant was not wearing a seatbelt. They could see a car going down the road, people in the back, people in the front, and say, I don't think that person's wearing a seatbelt. Now, how you're supposed to see that or know that when you're in a police vehicle, I have no idea, but to me, it's just a terrible policy. We limit the reasons why police can pull over civilian vehicles. I used the recollection when I was a law student. I visited my sister who was living in Moscow. I was in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Empire had fallen, and the country was under military rule. And the army would stop cars and make people get out and search their vehicles and ask for their papers, and you would have to pay, 20 rubles to get them off your back. I mean, it was crazy. And that, I looked at that and I'm like, now I understand why we have a Fourth Amendment in this country. So right. I recounted that anecdote and I spoke with some degree of passion and we killed it.
I tell you what, it was a horrible bill. It was definitely overreach and it was for no reason.
I mean, that's nobody's asking for this.
Exactly. So. Exactly. How do you get sometimes to this stuff where you get bills that nobody asks for? Like, how does that happen?
Well, there's an interesting concept whereby you get elected and you are in the community and you're talking to voters, and then you get down to Richmond and a whole group of people that never talked to you and issues that never popped up suddenly come flooding in your door and say, well, we got to do this, we got to do that, and, primary seatbelts. I mean, if you had asked me, I would have said 10 times out of 10, no way I'm voting for that. I mean, we had other bills that were similar where people came in and said, well, you got to vote for this, and the advocates want it, and they're like, hold on, I wouldn't even asked about that during the campaign, and if so, I would have said, hell no. So, that's just part of the process. I think there were a lot of lobbying groups that, because there was new leadership and, right. and new majorities, were very emboldened or entitled, whatever word you want to say, to think that somehow they got elected. And anyways.
The Senate became the backstop of reason. A lot of the stuff. How would you classify that?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting, and a lot of it's because we're 21-19, so if you lose even one or two Democrats, that kills a bill. And two, by and large, we've been in this business a while. Most of our members have 10, 15, 20 years at a minimum of elected experience. A lot of us were on city councils and local boards. And then three, we tend to be a little bit older and tend to have more of a background in business. And so, I think a lot of the policies that the House of Delegates passed, we may have agreed under the underlying policy, but we put it in a way that it was not so offensive or in your face to business or local government. I'll give you an example. Collective bargaining, obviously a big issue with the unions.
Right.
I realize that.
Right.
The House would have mandated it. We make it local option. So if your local government says, you know, we're willing to sit down with teachers and recognize their union, or sit down with firefighters and recognize their union, that's their local option.
Right.
But we're not going to force it down your throat.
Right.
Same thing, you know, on the some of these bills on sick leave. You know, we had that bill that would have required mandatory sick leave for part-time employees. Well, if you've ever owned a business, you recognize that's not how businesses operate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part-time and full-time employees are very different. One is, gets benefits and one does not, and that's how the IRS treats that, and that's typically how the economics work. And, you know, the House wanted to say, well, you got to give sick leave to everybody, even if they only work 8 hours a week. And then we said, no, hold on, slow down. You got to, if you're going to do this, you got to limit it to full-time employees, just like the ACA is limited.
Right.
So I wouldn't say we're more conservative or moderate. I think it's just
temperate.
Temperate. Yeah, temperate. We're just like, hold on, you got to work with people. You can't.
It's like
just
the adults in the room. I mean, yeah. and then that's a great example, Senator Peterson, that you bring up, which anybody that owns a small business, and you own a bigger business than I do, but we both own businesses.
Right.
I mean, look, I'm all for sick days, right? I mean, I get it, you know,
right.
and to your full-time employees, and you want to be sure they're okay, but you hire part-timers because for a reason.
And right, exactly.
To give them sick leave.
You're paying them a few, you know, they come in a few hours, but to give them sick leave is kind of nonsensical.
It's insane, and it's put forth by people that have never run a business and have no idea what they're doing. And so, yeah, you guys were temperate, I thought, in a lot of ways. And I tell you, though, I was shocked at the difference with the redistricting reform in the Senate and the House.
Right.
Like there was virtually no opposition in the Senate.
Right.
Like it went 38-2.
Right.
And in fact, there was enthusiasm for it amongst the Democrats.
Right.
And shockingly, Louise Lucas, who everybody loves. I mean, she's just a wonderful lady.
Just the queen of the Senate.
I mean, come on. She's just a queen. And she's been fighting for casinos that now passed since I've been here. And she was like an advocate of this.
Yeah, she was.
Tell us what happened.
Well, I think let me put a couple different spins on it. Those of us in the Senate, and we've been, you know, I've been in elected office now 22 years, 18 years in the Assembly. And if a redistricting commission was going to come back and draw a district, and it would, for whatever reason, that would be the end of my career, or I'd lose, you know, the seat I have now, I'd be fine with that. No problem with that. And I think those of us in the Senate, maybe we're on the back half of our career, and so we're at peace and with whatever happens. I'm not desperate about, oh my gosh, I got to preserve my seat. Because I feel like I've already done what I wanted to do, and so I think we're less nervous about preserving our own individual destiny. Maybe because we're just at a different stage in our career. That's number one. I think number two, with the Senate, you have a larger district, so you're used to talking to people that may have a different background, may have a different orientation, may have a different ethnicity. That's less of a big deal to you. There are some people that. They're like, God forbid I'd have to go talk to a group that's outside of my group if we get redistricted. And, I don't understand that thinking. Maybe I do understand it, but I just don't agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Senate, we had a lot of conversations in the Democratic caucus. Not everybody was on board. I had a couple of people that are like, hey, we've fought for 20 years to get the majority. Why do we give it away? And I understand that position.
Mm-hmm.
My position is, you know what? This is a legacy bill, first of all. This is a chance for us to do something that people 30, 40 years from now are going to rely on and appreciate. And secondly, if we truly believe Democrats are the majority party, then what are we scared of? Just draw
the
line.
Exactly. Yes.
What are you scared about?
Yes. That's the argument. Look, I'm a Republican. I was for this when the Republicans had 63 seats, okay? Because it's the right thing to do. And I remember saying the same thing to Bill Howe. What are you afraid of if you've got 63 seats?
Right.
What are you afraid of? That you might have 58 or 70? Who knows? Who cares? Look, the Republicans are not going to win in 2021 anyway. They're going to get beat again. So they have no party. They don't stand for anything. I don't even know what they're doing. So you guys are going to win anyway Why not do the right thing and make these districts make sense for people? And it, you're also spot on when you call it a legacy bill. But you're right. What are you afraid of?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. No. It was a good bill. You know, the commission itself, would I have set it up that way? No. But you know what? The bottom line was George Barker and Saslaw. They put that together. You know, they got that passed through the Senate. And that's what will go to the voters. It'll be basically a mix of legislative and non-legislative citizens. But the key is, it's bipartisan. You've got reps from both parties, and you're not going to have one side getting jerked over to maximize the other side's power. And that will make it very different from every other redistricting we've had since, 1776.
Well, Dick Saslaw, the godfather's 80 years old.
Yeah, so he's not worried about running for re-election.
Not running for re-election. Barker, George Barker, 77.
Yeah.
I mean, so, look, you combine their ages, it's 157 years or something.
Right.
I mean, these guys, to me, if they get behind something with that level of maturity and experience, I'm going to stand up and hear what they have to say. All right, let's get to, I know you've been fighting this a long time, marijuana decriminalization. What's your view?
Okay, well, we kind of took baby steps. We did have a decrim bill, which we did pass. I did vote for it, John, and this is not legalization, so don't say I'm being inconsistent, because it basically keeps civil penalties for marijuana use. There's still a bunch of issues we need to work out that we're going to have to do in 2021, which is, is marijuana use, is it penalty for smoking a cigarette now more serious than smoking a joint? What about underage drinking? I mean, we've got to find a way to kind of find some proportionality here between these, all these quote-unquote underage things. Marijuana use or possession in and of itself will be decriminalized. It will still be a civil penalty. Dealing it will still be, depending on the amount of that you have, a misdemeanor or a felony. So if you're out dealing without a license, you can still get charged with a felony. So it reflects what is, I would say, the popular will that possession of marijuana should not be a jailable offense. It will no longer be a misdemeanor. It will be a civil penalty. I agree with that. We weren't there 20 years ago. We're there now. The issue of legalization and having the state sell it and advertise it like Colorado or California, I do not think there's a majority for that in Virginia. I may be wrong. That bill may be coming along in the next few years. Lord knows we did everything else this year, but we did not do that.
You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. I'm with State Senator Democrat Chap Peterson, veteran lawmaker from Fairfax. Chap, let's get to driver cards for immigrants. Your buddy Scott Servell.
Right.
Very passionate on this. There's not a lot of things. Scott and I agree on a lot of things. We disagree on some things. I was not in favor of this, but I do have to say he made a compelling argument. What say you?
Well, take the clock back to 2001, prior to September 11th. Anyone who was residing in Virginia could get a driver's license. You didn't need to show proof of citizenship. You didn't need to show really anything other than you were living here and you had a car and you could drive the car. And we changed that law after 9/11 because we had become so basically loose in issuing licenses, and we said, no, you have to be here legally. And that meant that thousands and thousands of people that live and work in Northern Virginia suddenly lost the right to drive legally. Now, you can make the argument, we can talk for hours about, well, they're here, they shouldn't be here, they're taking jobs away from people, but as you know, the labor market in Northern Virginia, there's just not enough people up here for all the work. So that left the situation that we had people either driving illegally or taking the bus or walking or doing whatever. And we had a huge population of people that were not able to access licenses. Then the question became, well, do we go back to how it was pre-2001, that if you're here, you can show proof of residency, forget the legal, just proof of residency, and you can drive and you can get insurance, that you should have a license? Or the middle ground was the driver's privilege card, which is not a license. You can't use it to get on planes. You can't use it as a proof of ID. But it does show that you've passed the driver's course. It does show that you're insured. And if you're pulled over, you show it to police officer, you are driving with a license. And that was the middle ground we went with. We had a lot of conversations in our caucus, a lot of groups, advocacy groups that were wrapped up in this issue. Scott did a great job of kind of, you know, negotiating some pretty strong feelings. It was not an issue that, you know, that I dove into 100% right off the bat, even though, because I recognize that, listen, you have to make a distinction between people legal here, legally and not legally. But I do felt like it made sense, especially from the insurance perspective. You want people to be insured. You have a population that you need to address, and I think this is a good middle ground. I thought Scott did a great job.
I agree.
And
with
I voted
you.
For it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't like it because I just don't think if you're here illegally, you shouldn't. You should not be
right.
Here illegally.
No, and I understand that position.
But having said that. One thing I did like about it is, and I thought this was the most compelling argument Scott Servo made. He said, they're driving anyway. I mean,
right.
you're not stopping them from driving. They have to drive. They have to get to the jobs, which is the reason they're here. So they're driving anyway. They don't have insurance. You get in an accident, there's no insurance.
Right.
So at least what this does is in order to drive and be legit in Virginia, they have to have insurance, which means they're paying taxes, and it is what it is. So I get that. I get that side of the argument. Chad Peterson, with us, veteran Democratic State Senator Fairfax. Let's get to my favorite issue: casinos and sports betting.
You had a huge session. That was a session you all did a complete breakthrough on every level.
Boom.
Boom. Yeah, that's probably the right way to say it. Just boom.
Boom. I mean, for somebody like me who has been an advocate of both things for 10 years, in one session, you know, we knocked on the door, one session, we kicked it in and overran the place. So I got your going to the sports book OTB things, chap. I mean, that's when my father went to the OTB in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, where I grew up. He would go down the corner OTB. But those days are gone, man. People, they want to do it on their phone. They don't want to go to.
They don't want to go there. I know. And listen, I lost this battle. You know, I wanted to keep it bricks and mortar, and that got shot down. I mean, I really had nobody except the Colonial Downs that was in favor, and of course they ended up getting their pound of flesh by getting all the
all
the machines. You know, especially in Woodbridge. So this is one of those bills that it's going to take years to unpack. You know, I have a hard time imagining that all five casinos are going to open. They all got to go through local referendum, and obviously they're going to cannibalize each other's operations. So it's probably going to be the first couple past the post that are going to survive. I have a hard time seeing all five survive or even open. Yeah, I wasn't crazy about the historical horse racing in Woodbridge, but you know they've already approved that by referendum. That may be something that, again, could be something we need to go back and look at in future assemblies. You know, the bottom line was this is something that I voted for the bill. I wasn't crazy about it, but I do think that at some point we had rejected. And we'll see how it turns out. I mean, we're going to a large extent, let local governments have this opportunity, and whether or not they avail themselves of it will be up to them.
Well, listen, I know you want your 1970s back. It's gone.
Yeah, I know.
I get it. I mean, you want it back, but it's gone. Number two was voting for it. You did the right thing. But again, I mean, what you guys did in the state Senate, again, is a lot of this stuff, which is conservative thinking. Although you guys are progressives, you push the decision down to local governments where voters in their local districts have control over what they do. So you take these five areas, right? The voters have to pass the referendum. If the voters in those areas don't want them, they're not going to pass. That's number one.
Right.
Second thing is, after it passes, then the various entities, the applicants, operators, have to get an RFP.
Right.
It goes to the city council.
And they've got to make an investment. They've got to make that decision on their own.
Bingo.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know, you push it off on them. And as far as so that's the casino end of it. And I agree with you. I'm not sure we can support five casinos. I think we can support some of them, maybe not five. Who knows what the number is? We'll have to see what plays out. But as far as the bookmaking is concerned, you guys absolutely did the right thing, Chap, because that money is leaving Virginia. It's going to West Virginia, Dover Downs, offshore. The other thing I liked about it is you carved out Virginia colleges. I thought that was a great compromise, Chap.
I was not in the mix on that. Obviously, I've talked to the Redskins, and they had their own interest in it. And you know, I think the sports betting thing was something I got behind early. And I'm glad we passed that. That's going to happen in all 50 states, in my opinion. That's pretty much a no-brainer. And I did not like having college athletics in there, but I understand, you know, Final Four. I get all that. But I think taking the Virginia schools out of it is good, because it just, any impropriety, it just takes that away.
Chap, it was a good compromise. The other thing they did, that people that aren't familiar with this, with a betting on a phone, is the big money. I don't do this ever. It's just not my thing. But prop betting is like the whole big thing now.
Right, I know.
Is somebody going to hit the basket? You know, is somebody going to commit how many fouls? I mean, that's like a big thing. I've never bet it one time. I have no interest in it. I do want my 1970s back in that realm. But the reason they cut out that for all colleges is because it's compromising, right?
Right, right.
And so that makes sense.
Then you truly are putting a student athlete in a situation where they can miss a free throw or bobble a rebound, and you know, somebody makes $50,000, and
that's
a problem.
Yeah, that's an issue. So you cut that out. So, look, Chap, I think all that makes sense. But while casinos, it'll be a while before they actually happen, except probably for the one that the Pamunkeys will open in the Tidewater area, because that referendum is going to pass. They already have an RFP that the Norfolk City Council signed off on. Other than that, it's going to be a while. But the bookmaking starts in, like, I think in August, right? I mean, it starts immediately.
Yeah, well, we've been studying this for a year, and I think I think you can expect that. You'll see those licenses get issued, and I think there is an application process, but that will start this summer. You could have betting on NFL this fall.
Yep, no doubt. Okay, two more things, and then we got to go.
Yeah, I got to run, because I got a business meeting at 9:30. But yes, let's hit it quickly.
Washington Redskins.
Yeah,
where are we with that?
Where are we in terms of rebuilding the team, bringing them to Virginia, new coach? I did meet with the new coach. He's all business. I love it. No politics, all business. I had dinner with him, and we just talked football for 2 hours. And no interest in politics. It's great.
All right. So tell us about Chap Peterson, team president. Where's he going?
Well, you know, I got through this session. I don't think they're going to name a team president for a while. I think right now they've kind of got a team in place, and Rivera's got his thumbprint on it. And, you know, listen, I love the Redskins.
Are you still in the hunt?
You know what? I don't know if I'm in the hunt or not in the hunt. If they asked me to serve an executive position, of course I'd consider it. But at this point, you know, I've got a job, I've got a good business, and certainly got a Senate seat. So we'll see. My main thing is I want to see them get a good tight end, somebody who can get up the field for yardage. And as long as they got that, I'm happy.
How'd you get along with Morrissey?
Oh, great. Listen, Joe and I get along well, and was invited over to his house for a very lovely dinner. Went with a bunch of other senators, and he had an excellent session. He's a good influence in our caucus.
All right, Chap Peterson, got to go to a meeting. We're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us. Thank you so much.
Talk to y'all. Take care. Bye bye.
John Fredericks Radio Network. Stay with us.
You're listening to the John Fredericks Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. Online anytime at thejohnfredericksshow.com. Put your pinky rings up to the moon. Girls, what y'all trying to do? 24 karat magic in the air. Hands are tall, so clear. Look out. Pop, pop, it's showtime. Showtime. AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. The federal government's effort to ramp up testing for the coronavirus will initially prioritize healthcare workers and the elderly. The president, the Trump administration officials on Sunday described a targeted government-driven effort to screen for the virus and the most vulnerable Americans and those able to treat them. President Trump calling on Americans to cease hoarding groceries and other supplies amid the spread of the novel coronavirus. President says he has spoken with leading grocery store executives and that the food supply chain remains healthy. The Federal Reserve took emergency action Sunday, slashed its benchmark interest rate by a full percentage point to nearly zero. New York City will close the nation's largest public school system on Monday, sending over 1.1 million children home in hopes of curbing the spread of coronavirus. The city's mayor announced on Sunday, calling it a very troubling moment, as he suggested ominously that more restrictions were inevitable. More details at srnnews.com.
Thinking about life insurance? Did you know in just a few minutes you can find the best price from up to 10 price competitive companies for free? You can with SelectQuote. For example, George is 39. He was getting sky-high quotes from other companies because he takes meds to control his blood pressure. But when I shopped around, I found him a 10-year, $500,000 policy for under $22 a month. I'm SelectQuote agent Dan Savino, and believe me, if SelectQuote isn't shopping for your life insurance, you're probably paying too much.
For your free quote, call 800-494-2323. That's 800-494-2323. 800-494-2323. Or go to SelectQuote.com. Since 1985, we shop, you save.
Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Here's your community calendar from WBOB.
Saturday, March 21st, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's the Fernandina Beach Marketplace Farmers Market on North 7th Street in Fernandina Beach. And Saturday, March 21st, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., it's the Riverside Arts Market under the Fuller Warren Bridge on Riverside Avenue. Please note, due to the COVID-19 outbreak, many of these events have been canceled or postponed. Please verify prior to your attending.
For more information or to have your event included, visit WBOB.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and as you know, my passion is to help each and every one of you get the best sleep of your life. That's why I created my new Giza Dreams bed sheets. I started by using the world's best cotton called Giza. It's only grown in a region between the Sahara Desert, the Mediterranean Sea, and the Nile River, where the weather conditions are perfect for one crop, cotton. My bed sheets are ultra soft, breathable, and extremely durable. They come in a variety of colors, and now for a limited time, when you use your promo code, I'll give you my best offer ever. Buy one set of my Giza Dream Sheets and get another set absolutely free. I guarantee they're going to be the most comfortable sheets you'll ever own.
For limited time, go to MyPillow.com. When you buy a set of Giza Sheets, Mike will give you a set of Giza Sheets for free when you use promo code WBOB or call 800-950-9024 and give them promo code WBOB for this fantastic offer.
I'm Angela.
And I'm Howard.
And we're your hosts of Real Estate Radio.
About what's new in real estate and answer your questions about buying and selling.
Buying and selling a home is the biggest financial investment you will ever make.
Whether it's your first home or your last, or you're facing foreclosure, Real Estate Radio is the show for you.
Listen for Howard's help
and Angela's advice
and hot property picks in Northeast Florida.
Tune in and call in to Real Estate Radio every Saturday at 9 a.m.
AM 600, 101.1 FM. Talk radio, WBOB.
They don't call him the commander of common sense for nothing.
I'm not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican National Committee, the Democrat National Committee, any campaign or anybody else. So I'm going to call it like I see it.
Guess who got out of the wrong side of bed this morning?
Make sure to get your big boy pants on. No crybaby diapers.
There's no crying in baseball.
Here on the John Frederick Show.
Joining us now, Saltanat Bedikeva. And Saltanat, I hope I'm saying your name right. I'm trying my best. Saltanat Bedikeva. She is a senior contributor with Insider Arabia. Go to InsiderArabia.com. If you really want to get the news on what is going on in the Middle East, I found a new website that I love. You've got to get the truth out. That's why I go to Newsmax. Now I go to InsiderArabia.com. Check it out. You want to bookmark that. It's got great pieces on it. There's no spin, no bias. I just get the truth. I get information, and that's what I'm after. Go to InsiderArabia.com. She's a senior contributor, Saltanat Bedikeva. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Saltanat Bedikeva, indeed.
Very nice. And you're in Maryland, right?
No, I'm in Massachusetts at the moment.
Massachusetts. Well, I got the M right, right? I knew you were one of those M states. You're in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. Okay, could be a lot worse. You could be in Seattle. I don't think you want to go there right now.
No, thanks.
With the coronavirus, but Saltanat, thank you for being with us. I really do appreciate it. I know your time is very valuable here. I wanted to get your insight on the chaos in the energy sector that Mohammed bin Salman has caused with his 20% reduction in oil prices and his 20% cut in oil prices, and then also, along with that, his increase in production, all to compete with the Russians. Can you lay this out for us?
Sure. So I think this was going to happen because the alliance, so-called the OPEC Plus, which includes Russia, that started about 3 years ago, was kind of coming apart. It was just a question of when. But I think that it's the worst timing ever for any of them, because coronavirus is dampening the global oil demand, and more so now that we have restrictions on travel from Europe. So demand for oil is only going to go down, and there's no clear path to when it's going to go up. I think we're looking at several months, I don't know, maybe a year. We don't know how this coronavirus is going to play out. So I think it was not a good timing for Russia or Saudi Arabia to pick a fight, because I think whether they control, they don't really have a control over the situation. And now it's flooding the market with more oil, I think is going to hurt them more than they realize. And I think we're looking at a kind of a leadership that Saudi Arabia has at the moment, which is a very mercurial, very unpredictable leader who is very suicidal and kind of a suicide mission at the moment. And granted the fact that, yes, both Saudi Arabia and Russia are sitting on larger cash reserves, foreign currency reserves at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think Russia is sitting on about $570 billion and Saudi Arabia is about $500 billion. Mm-hmm. They think they have a financial cushion. But how long is it going to last? Maybe a year? They're both saying in a very kind of a macho, like kind of a, I'm going to be fine kind of way. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to last for a while. You know, Russia is saying, okay, we can deal with, what do they say, like about 25 to $30 a barrel of oil can last. We can last like 6 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia is coming out and saying, well, $10 a barrel will do fine with us for a while. But I think these are just these proclamations. We have seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. 2014, there was a 17-month oil price war, again, instigated by Saudi Arabia, really aimed at the U.S. shale producers. This time it's the same story. But that war, I think both, you know, either side is saying we won, but really Saudi Arabia lost it. Because at the end of the day, this is how OPEC Plus was created at 2016, mm-hmm. when they came together and said, okay, no, this oil price warfare is no longer working. We should mm-hmm. all come together and cut the production. Mm-hmm. And that boosted the prices up, and it's been going up, and then it crashed again. And I think it's just what they don't realize, both Russia and Saudi Arabia, is that they're constantly trying to see how far they can push to push out the U.S. oil producers. But I think here, both of them are aiming to really, their enemy is American shale producers, which is has been a wild card in the world oil market for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. So for them to push out the U.S. hasn't really worked out quite well, and I don't think it's going to work out this time either. So when 2014 and 2016 price war happened, they really thought it was going to hurt the U.S. producers, which it did. Mm-hmm. More than 100 American companies went bankrupt, and you know there was a lot of hurt. And I think American oil patch got a lot of beating. But they went back up. And right. it's actually the free market and the ingenuity of American energy producers really actually made it much more robust by mm-hmm. a way of improving efficiency, consolidation of a lot of, you know, smaller companies and mergers, you know, the companies that were bigger and had more financial reserves, they bought off the smaller ones that were not doing well. So we managed to survive. So American producers actually became stronger, and their break-even price actually went lower. In some parts of Bakken, the break-even price was at the time, I think, $25 per barrel. So that, you know, it's not across the board. Right now, there's a lot of debt in American companies that is going to bring them down. But I think, by and large, we are going to survive this. And I think that, you know, the OPEC trying to see if they can take a swing at the American producers again, I think it's just going to be the same story. They're going to come back in a few months and see if they can cut the production again. And I think the reason this time we are dealing with this scenario again is Mohammed bin Salman. Mohammed bin Salman wasn't quite there when the 2014 and 16 warfare price war was going on. He was just coming into play in Saudi Arabia. He was appointed around January 2015. He was appointed defense minister, and from then on, he was rising within the Saudi family. And June 2017, this is when he became crown prince. Mm-hmm. Ever since, all of his actions have been quite just wild. And just, you know, what happened with the journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Right.
You know, arresting a few months after he came to power, he arrested a bunch of royals and businessmen.
Right, he put him in the Ritz. He put him in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel under
right, held them captive.
Now he's arrested others. We're with Saltanat Bendikeva. She is a senior contributor to Inside Arabia. And this is the number one site that I go to now for news in the Middle East. Go to InsideArabia.com, Inside Arabia. After disrupting oil prices and sending the Dow Jones on a tumble along with the coronavirus, he turns around now. This is Mohammed bin Salman. He's got the reverse Midas touch, right? Remember Midas? Everything he touches, gold. Everything he touches turns to crap. I mean, the guy is a disaster waiting to happen on a daily basis. So Mohammed bin Salman, now he's arresting other potential rivals in his family, putting them in jail. What is the deal with this guy?
I think this is an attempt for power consolidation. I think, Mohammed bin Nayef, who his cousin who was arrested, he was before Mohammed bin Salman became crown prince. Mohammed Binayev, in April 2015, he was named as deputy crown prince. So he really pushed him out, and now he's, you know, he was under house arrest for a while, and I think he's officially in custody now. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, from you know, rumors, and you know, it's very hard to find the solid data on information on Saudi Arabia, but there are rumors that, you know, there was Mohammed Binayev and his other relative that was arrested as well were planning a coup, which I think is, you know, given the fact that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has big ambitions to become the heir, he does not want any of this competition. So for him to push them out and really consolidate power in Saudi Arabia is pretty much an explicit goal. So he, for him right now, it couldn't have come at the worst time when he has this vision for his country. I mean, vision is quote-unquote vision because it's not really working out. How can you have a vision for the country to wean yourself off of oil when you're really not helping it by flooding the oil market with more oil, and your own, you know, in Saudi Arabia really needs up to $86 per barrel to be able to maintain its balance sheet. So for him, oil production and high oil prices were kind of a vehicle towards diversifying the economy of Saudi Arabia, and that's what's been promising to his people. And now I think Saudis who see this chaos and, you know, House of Saud was always, you know, very secretive, and things were done in a very kind of a behind the scenes, but they were a lot more stable. But I think now he's this wild, kind of a wild card within the family who's just really throwing things into chaos. And I think that I'm not really sure how it's going to play out, to be totally honest. I think he's gambling a lot, and I think it's going to hurt him. It's hard to tell how, but I think he's gambling with the oil market for sure. I think it's going to end up hurting the Saudi economy, which already laden with huge debt.
Right.
And I think they're going to lose a lot of revenue, up to $140 billion revenue this year, if the oil price is going to stay where they are, and the you know, war with Russia and American producers going to continue. But I think that internally also, like the fact that he all of these chaotic decisions happened in 1 week is pretty stunning. You know, the purging of the family members and then closing off access to Mecca for pilgrimages, and actually also you know, closing off Eastern Province, the restive part of the Shia part of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Allegedly for the coronavirus problem, also is a concern because it's actually a political thing, I think, underlying it. And so a lot of his actions are very unpredictable, and it's all happening, and the plunge of the oil prices and everything is happening in 1 week. So it's very – so he's just this, like he thrives on a disaster. He thrives on the – chaos, it seems like, and I'm not really sure how it's sustainable, and I don't know if
I think that's
anybody
it.
What you just said there,
Saltanat, is this sustainable? And you said he's gambling. He's gambling, and he's losing, right? And he keeps doubling down, right? He gambled
right.
on this oil price cut. That's going to prove not to be successful. He gambled on the blockade with Egypt, Bahrain, and UAE on the state of Qatar. That backfired. Qatar economy is better than ever. Theirs is a disaster.
Right.
So he gambled on that. It backfired. He gambled in the war, the Yemenis with the Houthis and Iran. He's losing that. He gambled on that. That backfired. He's not winning that. And here's what he's putting at risk. He's putting the U.S. long-term relationship with KSA, that collaboration, that alliance is now getting strained. And I'm telling you, at some point, President Trump is going to say, I've had it with this guy. I mean, that day of reckoning is not far away.
I think particularly, I think you're right. I think it's going to hurt the U.S.-Saudi relations as well. Because what he's doing right now, it's not only, I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of a good thing that when the oil prices are low, but when it's intentionally done to hurt American producers, which what really Saudi Arabia and Russia are aiming at, I think if a bunch of our companies are starting to go bankrupt and thousands of workers start to lose jobs in, you know, in North Dakota, Texas, et cetera, right, then we are talking something else. I think in that case, that's going to really affect our relations. I think, you know, President Donald Trump, I think, is going to have probably less of a patience if, on top of coronavirus, which is affecting global economies, including American economy, and then we're having, you know, a lot more unemployment in the oil sector. I think there's going to be a little bit of a friction there for sure.
Well, it's a day of reckoning. It's coming. You know, I think what the Trump administration is doing right now is they're respecting the long-term alliance, the long-term relationship with KSA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, not directly with Mohammed bin Salman. You got to remember, too, that Mohammed bin Salman got on the hot phone with the president and essentially lied to him, right? I mean, you really think about that? When you really think about a world leader getting on the phone with a leader of the free world, whether it's Trump, Clinton, George W. Bush, H. Bush, Obama, doesn't matter, getting on the phone with a leader of the free world and lying to them. And that's what Mohammed bin Salman did. He got on the phone with President Trump over Jamal Khashoggi and said he didn't know anything about it. He had nothing to do with it. And now we all know that he concocted the whole thing. The president can't trust him. So the relationship is with KSA. It's not with Mohammed bin Salman. And he continues to get himself deeper and deeper in all these crazy things. I mean, the guy's intemperate. He's a loose cannon. You don't know from one day to the next what he's going to do. And, you know, if you're the powers to be in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, I mean, you got to be looking at this guy wondering what your future is. I don't think it's positive.
I think there are two things in there. So not only his kind of gambling, his relationship, or taking for granted, so to speak, with United States, which has been a long-term ally of the of Saudi Arabia. I think Saudi Arabia is also at risk of alienating itself in the Muslim world. And I think that's also going to not look favorable to MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. And I think what some of the things he had done in, you know, towards some of the Muslim leaders was also disrespectful and condescending in a way. So I think he's, by doing that and by closing down pilgrimages, which is understandable to a degree, but I think it's very hard to say how many of the virus infections are in Saudi Arabia, and just like lack of transparency for his own political goals, it's not going to look favorable to him. And the other thing is the economy, I think, is going to catch up with it. I don't know how long he's going to play this game. I mean, last time the price war lasted for about 2 years, and Saudi Arabia has waged price wars historically in 1987. I'm sorry, 1985, 1997, right before the Asian economic crisis, 2014. So it's nothing new, really, as far as what Saudi Arabia can do. And it really does it to kind of a lot of times to kind of hit back at the fellow OPEC producers. So it was really angry at Venezuela at some point because it was overproducing. So it you know, decided to flood the market. And then that was in 1997. And then in 2014, he took an aim at the American shale producers. I think what they don't realize is that America, yes, we do export. We are one of the largest. We are the largest oil producer in the world at the moment.
Right.
But we are not dependent on one commodity for our national revenue.
There's so much natural gas now that the U.S. is producing as well. Has become, you know, a big part of the energy sector. But I'm out of time for this segment. I really want to thank our great guest, great conversation, Saltanat Betikeva. Saltanat Betikeva, she is a senior contributor with Inside Arabia. Go to InsideArabia.com for all your news in the Middle East. That is now my go-to website and digital news. They're based in Washington, D.C., which makes it a lot easier because you get everything in English. InsideArabia.com, InsideArabia.com. Go there. And Saltanat, thank you for your insight, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. Online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.
March 14th, 1879. Physicist Albert Einstein, considered the greatest scientist of the 20th century, is born in Germany.
It is intelligence, which is the ability to learn from experience, to plan ahead. It includes the capacity to give up immediate temporary benefits for permanent ones.
1794, Eli Whitney receives a patent for his cotton gin, an invention that revolutionizes America's cotton industry. 1995, astronaut Norman Thagard becomes the first American to enter space aboard a Russian rocket. And 1933.
Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England.
Actor Michael Caine, whose movie roles include Alfie and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, is born in London. Also that same year, composer and conductor Quincy Jones is born in Chicago. He's best known for producing Michael Jackson's Thriller album and the song We Are the World. Today in history, March 14th, Sandy Kozel, The Associated Press.